The World Behind the Wall, Global Backgrounds of Maps and Ambitions in 16th Century Italy, the Giuseppe Marcocci. Monsieur Marcocci est professeur associé de l'histoire moderne à l'Université de Viterbo, mais aussi professeur associé à l'Université de Florence. Il a publié plusieurs livres dans les derniers temps. Le livre qu'il vient de publier en 2016 chez La Terza, c'est « Indios Cinesi Falsari, l'histoire du monde nel Rinascimento ». Mais avant ça, il a aussi publié autour de l'Empire portugais et aussi autour de l'Inquisition et l'Église au Portugal. Donc, il est à la fois spécialiste de Portugal, mais aussi du monde méditerranéen et de plus en plus s'intéresse à l'histoire globale. La parole est à vous.
Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup, professeur Subramaniam. Je suis désolé pour parler en anglais, mais je ne maîtrise plus la langue, un petit peu. Mais j'espère que mon accent italien aidera tout à comprendre plus ou moins ce que je veux dire. The visual turn in history encourages new approaches to maps. And in a way, it relieves them from the radar esoteric expertise of the historians of cartography. So what I want to do today is to focus on the cycles of wall maps of the world that were depicted in some palaces of power in mid-16th century Italy. A few cases are rather known, others are not. So I will try to put them in connection. And it is important to observe at the beginning of my speech that not all of this production has been the object of scholars, because there is a tendency, exactly in the line Professor Subramaniam was highlighting, to look at these maps from the point of view of their position regarding the most advanced knowledge in the time. Since many of these maps are not the most advanced product of the time, they have generally been disregarded by historians of cartography. However, there is some recent interest in the fact that, I quote Francesca Fiorani, an art historian from Virginia University, by interacting with other symbolic forms, particularly the non-cartographic images surrounding them, these map cycles became the primary vehicles in the construction of political legitimacy, religious supremacy, or universal knowledge. Yet, this perspective, in my view, still looks at them from the inside out. For instance, it just considers the creators or the persons who realized these maps, and generally it provides Italian, if not local, interpretations of the iconographic programs that were behind these maps. I will move in another direction today, exploring maps as visual evidence of the global interactions that marked the context of production of these maps. Now, the highest examples of these wall maps are in the hall of the Guardaroba Nuova of the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence, and in the room of the world map in the Villa Farnese at Caprarola. I will return to these two famous examples in the second part of my presentation. Probably these two examples drew inspiration from the mid-16th century president of the Scudo Room of the Doge's Palace in Venice. A lesser known case, because what we have today are 18th century remakes of the original maps. The original maps were deteriorated, and so they were replaced by the current maps we have that are not at all the faithful reproduction of the original. So they are rather different. And this situation is important because absence of images is also part of the way in which historians can deal with the visual sources and visual turns in history. So I think this is also something which is important. It had been in 1550 when the Council of Ten, a political board of the Republic of Venice, ordered to realize world map on large canvases for the reception room of the Doge's apartment. Since we don't have them, let me quote another passage from a description in the early 17th century of these originals. They were split into four big pictures, taking up the whole space between the backrest and the ceiling, in which this description says, one sees carefully depicted all the parts of the world. They are relevant, in my view, these maps, of course, for their connection to with the first long-distance exchanges that were occurring in the time, but also for their creator. And I'm not thinking of the famous cartographer Giacomo Castaldi, who was the man who realized these maps, but of the secretary of the Council of Ten, who personally wrote the contract that we still have for the work, the well-known humanist Giovanni Battista Ramusio. A great collector of travel wrappers, chronicles, and maps, he developed a lively consciousness of the shifting knowledge of the world, also thanks to his experience as diplomat and his close links to major historians of the Iberian explorations, for instance, the Spanish Gonzalo Fernández de Oviedo or the Portuguese Damião de Góis, who was in close contact with them. Ramusio supported, and this is very important in my view, Venice's imperial ambitions to preserve the dominion over coasts and islands of the Eastern Mediterranean, a political project that was at the root of his monumental work, Navigazioni et Viaggi, a collection of historical and geographical writings translated into Italian and published in Venice from 1550 on, the same year in which the contract with Gastaldi was signed for the maps. And the coincidence of dates with Gastaldi's appointment is not fortuitous and helps us to understand the kind of message the Doge wanted to convey to visitors through world maps. The instructions to Gastaldi that we have attached to the contract show that he was asked to pay special attention to the text selected by Ramusio for the Navigazioni's first volume, including Hassan al-Wazan al-Garnati al-Fazi, also known as Leo Africanus, for the map of Africa that had to be integrated with Alvise da Cadamosto, for the Atlantic shores, a 15th century Venetian traveler who had witnessed the Portuguese explorations along the African coast. Then Francisco Alvarez, another Portuguese who had visited Ethiopia, had to be followed for the map of the land, what is called in the contract, the land of Prester John, that is the Ethiopia, and Duarte Barbosa for that of the routes of the Portuguese navigations. So this is the initial duty that Gastaldi had from Ramusio. And it is evident that initially Venice was just interested, was not interested in the world, but was just interested in the regions their commercial rivals, that is in this case the Portuguese, had reached. So there is some political and better commercial interest behind these maps. A change occurred for political reasons, and it is very interesting. Since Gastaldi was not able to keep the deadline for the work and justified himself arguing that in the map of Africa, let me quote him, it is necessary to add to the part that would remain empty that word discovered by the Spaniards 50 years ago. That is, Hispaniola, Cuba, New Spain, the land of Peru, and the Pacific Ocean. So this was the reason why we don't have anymore, but we had this map as completed, not the initial commitment, but that the initial commission that had been given to Gastaldi, but rather a very practical reason that had to be approved by a committee, an official committee that praising this decision, saying that the inclusion of this word and the newfound lands, Paesi Nuovamente Ritrovati, that was a famous title in the literature of the late 15th, early 16th century, it was to be praised, this inclusion, so that not only the Spaniards, but also our own people will recognize them. So there is also a kind of civic interest behind these maps. Including the America, Gastaldi anticipated what we could call the American turn of the Venetian publishers, who issued an increasing number of books about the New World by Spanish and Italian authors starting from the following years. The reorientation toward the whole world of the Scudo's Room maps paralleled the preparation of the two new volumes of the Navigazioni by Ramusio. As is proved, again, by a second contract signed by Gastaldi with the Council of Ten in 1553 for the depiction this time of America and Asia as a unique continental mass, according to the common belief of the time. Here you have a map that is derived from a Gastaldi model that more or less gives us an idea of what we are talking about. As stated in the contract, Gastaldi, I quote, had to check all the wrappers he will be given of Castilian, so we can to image him working with people giving him wrappers about travel literature. And these wrappers are of Castilian captains who went across and wrote about that land, especially Alvaro Nunez, the French Jacques Cartier for New France, Jean de Barros for the geography of China, and the nobleman Marco Polo for Cathay, a very interesting mix that is also included in the volumes by Ramusio that contain both, let's say, medieval and modern authors. And the volumes of Ramusio containing these authors were published exactly in the second half of the 1550s, so more or less, again, in parallel with this Scudo Room. Now, the genesis of a wall map of the world, as we have seen, could be complex, and its background was made of a variety of cultural transfer which might overlap a publishing project with global reach. Moreover, ambitions that we rarely credit to the weak political powers of 16th century Italy fostered such an undertaking. These ambitions were a mix of trade interest and vague dreams of greatness, but they urged to search for fresh new maps and news, information, ensuring a constant flow of materials, a constant flow of knowledge towards those Italian centers hoping to keep some role in the world balance of power in redefinition. For example, as early as 1501, when the big news was still Vasco da Gama's journey to India, Angelo Trevisan, a secretary of the Venetian ambassador in Castile, succeeded in taking possession of, I quote, a maps to Calicut and the region that are behind it. And it is very interesting that Trevisan constantly stresses in his letters to the Republic of Venice that this map can replace direct experience. So there is already this strong idea that this visual evidence of this map is something very important from this point of view. If we can understand, however, this episode as part of Venice's reaction to the Portuguese challenge, according to a line that Ramusio still followed in his discourses on spices were the main point of contention between Portuguese and Venetians in this period. Another famous theft that has already been mentioned by Professor Subramaniam of a map makes things much more complicated. I refer to the Cantino map. I don't need now to repeat the story. But it's interesting that this map was displayed on the walls of the library of the Duke of Ferrara, Ercole d'Este. It is a very telling map of the Portuguese knowledge of the world in the late 15th century. However, with respect to the Venetian cases we were considering, this map cannot be understood. It was reproduced illegally by the secret agent Cantino for the Lord, but this reproduction cannot be understood as something meant to support the imperial ambitions of a Renaissance prince in this case, because the Duke of Ferrara ruled on a very small state without access to the sea. So this put his case in a very different situation with respect to the Venetian case. Yet this map, this search for it, this display of it in the library, demonstrate to what extent Italian culture at the time was interested in the new knowledge of the world, shaped by increasing contacts and exchanges on a global scale. However, it was not just a matter of cartography. As is shown, for instance, by the octaves of the Canto 15 of Orlando Furioso, a very famous poem of the time, in which Ludovico Ariosto, writing a few years after the reproduction of the Cantino map exactly in the same environment, in the Ferrara court and staying in the library in which this map was present, include an account of the in form of prophecy of the explorations carried out by the Iberians, who, I quote a line from Ariosto, in the manner of the circling sun to seek new lands and new creations run. So there is already also in the literature this strong connection with images and the information arriving from the Iberian Peninsula. Visualization of the world gained a centrality which encourages to revise established interpretations about 16th century Italy and to rediscover the impact of global connections on places that we tend to keep separate from the front line of overseas explorations and empire-building projects. I think not only of Ariosto's Ferrara, which is an obvious case, but if we move more ahead in time until the mid-16th century, also of the enigmatic cases of frescoes of globes and planisphere realized in isolated localities in northern Italy. Let me start with the case of the Castle of Manta, which is in today Western Piedmont. The decoration of the vault of the Hall of Grotesque, dated to 1563, includes a remarkable globe dominated by a crown and surrounded by a scroll with a quotation from Book 6 of the Aeneid saying, "The spirit nourishes within." And it is interesting, this quotation, because it is taken from a section of Virgil's poem that at the time was generally interpreted as one of the many prophecies of the ancients about the discovery of the New World. So it is not by chance that the side of the world we have in the globe is the Atlantic side, because there is a kind of clear program here behind. But it is surprising to find this globe in a rather isolated castle that belonged to Michele Antonio Saluzzo della Manta, who was at the time the ruler of the Marquisate of Saluzzo, in a period in which this Marquisate was annexed to France. I will return to this political detail because I think it's important, but let me move to another not very well-known case, I think. It is another northern Italian palace, the Palazzo Besta, which is in Teglio, a village of the Valtellina, an alpine region that at the time had been conquered by the Swiss canton of Brionz. And this also promoted the penetration of the ideas of reformation in this part of northern Italy. In the ceiling of the Room of Creation, I'm sorry, the image is not very well, but it's clear, we have a planisphere, which is a reproduction of a map by the German Kaspar Vopel. But I'm not exactly interested in the fact of from what model this map was imitated, but more of the context and the people that were around the commissioner of this map, who was Carlo Besta, a little lord of northern Italy, that at the time looked for his political action, acting under the shadow of a wider power, the Grayons. He was married to a Calvinist from Grayons. He had close relationship to the Germanic world. And he also was a protector of the Lombard humanist Hortensio Lando, a man suspected of heresy by the Roman Inquisition, who, among many other things, is the translator into Italian of Thomas More's Utopia. So we have a very interesting background of this map. Both these examples we have looked at are not very much studied. There is no literature on this, except for very small little references. We can look at them as a demonstration of a wider circulation of this theme in the early decades of the second half of the 16th century, which is the flourishing period of the wall maps of the world in Palace of Power in Renaissance Italy. Now, what is important for me is that this the commissioners of these two maps were small lords, and that they were, in a way, also trying to escape the new hegemonic powers in Italy at the time. In the case of the Piedmont and the case of the Castel of Manta, the expansion of the House of Savoy, but more interestingly, in the case of the Carlo Besta and Valtellina, the hegemonic power of Spain and the Hispanic monarchy on the Duchy of Milan. So this is an interesting point if we connect it to the fact that in the Spanish part of Italy that was relevant at the time, not only the Duchy of Milan, but all the southern part of the peninsula, we don't find any example of word maps on the wall. So this iconographic theme seems to be present only in parts of Italy in which there is not the presence of Spanish power, which is something which is apparently in contrast to the fact that in the same years, in the 70s, early 80s, King Philip II adorned his throne room with maps from all over the world. So my impression here is that the presence of these maps could also convey a sense of contestation to the Spanish power and to its pretension to have a global reach at the time. And this detail is something to keep in mind while we address now the two renowned examples of the Hall of the Guardaroba Nuova in Florence and the Room of the World Maps at Caprarola. My aim is not to discuss the abundant literature on these two cases that have been generally studied as isolated. So they have rarely been put together and looking at the backgrounds that connect them. What I want to show is the relationship between the Italian peninsula and the gradual consciousness of the transformation of the knowledge of the world through a number of connections that work behind these two maps that are particularly interesting. So I want to emphasize the key role played by cultural brokers who kept Italy in constant touch with this, the production of this knowledge, both in the Iberian Peninsula in this period, but also outside Europe, because there were many Italian merchants, missionaries, skilled workers that constantly sent reports and materials to the Italian powers that can be and must be considered to understand this production. Because I think that this is an important background that has been disregarded to understand the cases of Florence and Caprarola. Of course, Florence and Caprarola means the Medici and the Farnese family. These were two great families of the period in Italy, and they had produced the most important popes of the first half of the 16th century. Here we have a very famous painting of Pope Paul III. And this is important because at the time the Roman Curia had still some influence on the Iberian imperial projects. For instance, it tried to control the jurisdiction of the crowns. It provided some grammar to the ideological debates. And most of all, the church still claimed to have a spiritual power over the globe, whose agents were the missionaries. So in this period, the political balance of the exploration was still something in which the church pretended to play some direct role. When the Farnese and the Medici became unable to have its members as pope, elected as pope in the second half of the 16th century, both these families did not lose their interest in the wider world. On the contrary, as we will see. And even if from a formal point of view, the cases of Caprarola and Florence are quite different, as we are going to see, there are some brokers and people behind that are the same one. And so this is very important to keep in mind. And let me introduce you a key figure in this story that has not been considered in the literature on these two famous cases. I refer to Giovanni Ricci da Montepulciano. Giovanni Ricci da Montepulciano was an ecclesiastic of humble origin. He was at the service of the Farnese for a long time, but also kept close relationship with the Medici. It's interesting that he often visited the Iberian Peninsula, where he was appointed in 1544 as Papal Nuncio, first in Portugal, then in Spain. At his return in 1551, he was elected cardinal, so he became also to have some importance in the city of Rome, some autonomous importance. But his previous year's intense experience in Iberia strongly marked his behavior. He was known with the epithet of the Portuguese, and he acted as a kind of tireless go-between, and between the peninsula and the Iberian Peninsula and Italy, and he was probably at the time the major importer of Asiatic objects toward Italy. He gifted this object to cardinals and lords, first of all, the Farnese, especially Alessandro Farnese, the Grand Cardinale, who was a grandson of Paul III, but first of all, a great protector of artists, humanists, and literature, but also to Cosimo I, the Medici. We have a description of the Cabinet of Curiosity that Ricci organized in his building in Via Giulia at Rome in 1558. And this cabinet reflected his taste. It included, for instance, carpets, necklace objects, crystals and jewels from India, Indo-Portuguese chests, many pieces of Chinese porcelain, and a great framed war map. The frescoes painted by Francesco Salviati in the northern wall, especially here, this room. I will show you a better picture now. In the northern wall of the great hall of his house contains biblical scenes from the life of David. However, according to Sylvie de Svarterosa, an art historian that I've worked a lot with Portuguese and Portuguese-Italian relations, the style used in this wall would imitate Chinese hanging scrolls with painting, part in red, some of which might have been part of Ricci's collection, and two Chinese, and also it include two Chinese standards with personal emblem of Ricci in yellow. I'm sorry, the picture is not so fine, but I wasn't able to have access to the palazzo to take pictures. And these two standards are placed side by side with two covered porcelain jars, of which we have a description connected to their presence in Ricci's collection. So it seems that this wall could have some strong relationship with the collection. Now, Ricci shared his fascination for China with Cosimo I de' Medici, with whom he developed a close relationship exactly in the years in which he was creating his Cabinet of Curiosities, late 1550s, and Francesco Salviati was depicting these frescoes. And it is difficult to think that Ricci had no role in the conception of the whole of the Guardaroba Nuova, which Giorgio Vasari and Miniato Pitti projected for Cosimo I's new apartment in the Palazzo Vecchio. The room was meant to contain the collections of Cosimo I, including a myriad of pieces of Chinese porcelain. So this is something that surely attracted very much Ricci. And the close relationship between the two men is confirmed, for instance, by the fact that in the late 1560s, Ricci was appointed as Archbishop of Pisa, a city in Tuscany, which allowed him to have a still closer relation with Cosimo I de' Medici. The beginning of the depiction of these maps is dated to 1564, and they were entrusted to Ignazio Danti. Now, it is probably Ricci who suggested Ignazio Danti in 1569 to ask the Florentine agent Bernardo Neri, who was departing to Lisbon, to contact the Portuguese chronicler João de Barros, I quote, to get a copy of the Cosmography of China that he says he translated from Chinese into Portuguese. An information that Barros, the chronicle Barros provides in the Decades of Asia, his very famous chronicle of the Portuguese fleets in the Indian Ocean world. Neri was also charged with the duty to discover if Barros, I quote again from Dante's letter, has any map of that country and province of China, Manji and Katai, and especially any information of the great city of Kinsai, trying to get a copy of it. So he had a precise thing to do. And Dante stressed that there could be no finer gift for Cosimo I, since, I quote from the letter, no good information of the above mentioned places exist. So while Dante is depicting, he's looking for this information, and the presence of Barros here is very important. And he was already there in the case of Ramusio, but as we will see, he's already behind the case of Caparola in a direct connection, not in just as a literary source. Probably Neri didn't meet the aged Barros, but we are not sure about it because he died in the year later after, in 1570. But he met the Portuguese explorer and fanciful author Fernão Mendes Pinto, the author of a very important travel account in Asia. And he asked Pinto exactly, I quote from a letter in which Neri tells his encounter with Mendes Pinto, the things of China and its cities, information about the things of China and its cities on behalf, explicitly on behalf of Cosimo I de' Medici. Beside this, it seems that Neri stole a Buddhist codex from Mendes Pinto as well. So again, we have maps, materials, and this strong Oriental interest in the people that are behind the realization of these maps. The debate contained in the legend of Dante's map, I'm sorry, it's very little, but it's very complex debate about the different information we have on China and in which Barros authority is considered the most important, reflects these global backgrounds, this attempt to arrive to fresh news through many passages thanks to mediators, as well as the fact, just to add one more example of this attitude, that for the representation of Madagascar map, Dante could follow Portuguese manuscript maps available at the Medici court. So again, this amount of materials that today we have lost, that we ignore, that were behind these maps are relevant here. The map, the room of the world map of the Villa Farnese at Caprarola can be approached in a similar way. In his youth, Alessandro Farnese had Ricci as his head servant. The Grand Cardinale, who always kept a close relationship with Ricci, also because of the multiple Farnese connection to Portugal, both individual of Alessandro and his family, there were marriages between the Portuguese royal family and the Farnese and the period, so this reinforced the relationship, but Ricci was the man that managed many of these relationships. The Grand Cardinale ordered to realize the world maps in his villa in 1573, in the aftermath of his attempt to be elected Pope. So there was again an attempt of a Farnese to become Pope that was frustrated because it was elected Ugo Boncompagni as Gregory XIII. There is an interpretation that says that probably Alessandro Farnese was inspired by a project, an ongoing project at the time, a project underway at the time in the third loggia of the Vaticano showing world maps. But we have to consider that in the early 70s, this project was still largely incomplete, and it was only after that the Villa Farnese's room was completed that Ignazio Danti depicted on the third loggia the two famous world hemispheres that we see. So again, these two men who had fought for the papacy has both this interest in the world, which is particularly interesting. Moreover, we have some written material lost, to be sincere, behind the Caprarola project. For instance, a discourse on the subject of the cosmography of the room of Caprarola written by the project creator Orazio Trigino De Mari. And following this kind of material, the art historian Laura Partridge has maintained that we should interpret the room as a millenarian narrative of the history. Let me go back just a second to the room. Of the history of mankind, intended to comfort a frustrated prince of the church, Alessandro Farnese, who took refuge in his magnificent palazzo lost in the countryside of Lazio. This is the Villa Farnese from outside. While I agree with Partridge about the possible interpretation of this map as visual historiography, I'm less convinced of the prophetic content of the iconographic program. The Grand Cardinale, who visited frequently Ricci's building in Villa Giulia, something that we have always to keep in mind, that this constant immaterial contact with maps and objects that might have inspired his taste, also was strongly connected to the writing of word histories that was a rather flourishing genre in Italy at the time. Even if the most popular author, Giovanni Tarcagnota, dedicated his Historia del Mondo, published in 1562, to Cosimo I, the Medici, he was a member of the circle of humanists who met under the patronage of Alessandro Farnese. So, exactly as Ricci, also Tarcagnota is a kind of man halfway between Farnese and the Medici, again. We can draw a parallel, perhaps, between the way in which Tarcagnota's successor, Mambrino Roseo, continued his histories up to the present, and the possible source of inspiration behind the room of the world map at Caprarola. Just as Mambrino Roseo used the letters by Jesuit missionaries as preferred documents for his world history, so Farnese, who was probably the most prominent protector of the Jesuits at the time, heavily relied on their advice. If so, the idea to have not only the regions of the world, as in the case of the whole of the Guardaroba, depicted in the reception room, including an historical comparison between the ancient Judea and the modern Italy that we have on one of the walls of the room, but also the famous planisphere, might reflect the intention to convey a sense of Farnese's support to the real expansion of the spiritual power of the church across the globe, embodied by Jesuit missionaries. And this might be intended as a political act, and this might be referred also to the idea that some of these maps have a kind of anti-Spanish meaning, because we should also remember that at the time the Spanish crown favored the rival orders of the Jesuits in East Asia, challenging the exclusive access to China of the Jesuits that were understood as a kind of imperial agents of Portugal. So this could be also something to be kept in mind. A reading of the room as a world history culminating in the global triumph of the church, thanks to the Grand Cardinale, is consistent with motifs in other walls of the villa that are mainly devoted to episodes of the history of the Farnese family in the 16th century, many of which are connected to important moments in European history and political crisis. So this would be current, in my view, with this presence. A further aspect to consider is that Tarcagnota and Mambrino, these two authors of the Historia del Mondo, drew inspiration clearly from the popular histories of his time by the humanist Paolo Giovio, published between 1551 and 1553. Although they focus these Giovio's histories on Europe and the Mediterranean, they show significant interest in the Ottoman and Safavid empires and devote famous passages to China and the New World. Giovio too was an historian writing under the patronage of the Medici and the Farnese. So once again, we have this kind of connection. And the passage, but more interestingly, the passages on the non-European world in his histories would rely on, I quote, a book written in Chinese and another in Portuguese, in Persian, containing some information on the manners of the Gentiles of those land, an information which is provided by João de Barros, again, who says to have given on Farnese's request to Giovanni Ricci in 1548 these materials so as to have them available to Giovio. They might be the Tarig, the Persian text might be the Tarig often mentioned by Bardas, which Professor Subramaniam has proposed to identify with the Rawzat al-Safa, the Garden of Purity, the encyclopedic chronicle by the Persian-speaking historian Mir Kvant, while the cosmography of China, mentioned in Barros' text with regard to the material sent to Giovio, might be the same book, that the same material, the same object that 20 years later Dante asked Bernardo Neri to get a copy for him in Lisbon. So here again, we see a lot of connections that integrate the materials of the two map cycles. All this conveys a picture of the Grand Cardinale that is rather different from that provided by Claire Robertson in Farnese's biography. The iconographic elements connected to the oceanic navigations in the Planisfera Caprarola, which are absent in all the other maps I have discussed in this presentation, as well as the portraits of explorers and conquerors on the wall of the room, confirms that Farnese was anything but indifferent to the world outside Europe, as Robertson instead maintains. Hernán Cortés' portraits offered him a direct link to the personage in the flesh, since it is an accurate copy, this one, of the painting The Conquistador, sent again to Giovio in 1541 for his museum on Lake Como, possibly to be displayed alongside, I quote from a Giovio's letter, a bizarre piece of an idol of Temistitan, of Tenochtitlan, which he asked for to the Papa Nuncio in Spain, a further demonstration of the plurality of contexts and materials that made these artworks an example of the global Renaissance. We have here another copy of the portrait, which is today at the Uffizi, which is generally considered a copy of the portrait that Giovio owned. But this is much more similar to the description that Giovio gives of the portrait. We can conclude our itinerary asking ourselves what effects these wall maps could induce in an Italian prince of the period. Let me consider the case of Ferdinando I de' Medici, who became Grand Duke of Tuscany in 1587. You should not be surprised to learn that Giovanni Ricci had been the tutor of Ferdinando I de' Medici in his youth. After the latter's death, after Giovanni Ricci's death, it was Ferdinand, then a cardinal in Rome, who bought in 1576 the wonderful villa that Ricci had recently built on the Pincian Hall, today known as Villa Medici. In a recent book, Lia Marchi has shown to what extent Ferdinando I's test turned more and more towards the Americas, thus developing his father Cosimo I's collection in a more global direction. You have here a couple of frescoes that were realized in under Ferdinando I that gives you an idea of it. We can make a connection between Ferdinando's cultural interest and the colonial projects he dreamt of from the late 16th century on. He abandoned the purpose to have a settlement in Larache, Morocco, where he wanted, I quote, to build a fortress and promote the navigation of his subjects, from a letter of the time, in 1604, only to take advantage of instability in Syria and try to obtain a port in the region in 1607. So in these years, he's trying still to have a strategy connected to the Mediterranean world and the Northern Africa, but relying on the information and recommendation that were sent him by his agents on the ground. But this attempt to transform personal knowledge often developed at the service of private companies by these merchants, into state-sponsored colonial projects, experienced the most dramatic moment when Ferdinand I, aiming to penetrate the Atlantic trade through settlements in Sierra Leone and above all in Brazil, organized a disastrous expedition to the New World in 1608. The Hispanic monarchy's opposition suppressed any hope for a Medici's small overseas empire. We may wonder, however, to what extent the hours spent by Ferdinando I in the hall of the Guardaroba Nuova had fostered his political ambitions. This evocative picture of the Grand Duke of Tuscany allows us to rethink the world maps, whose global backgrounds I've tried to highlight in my presentation, as visual traces of cultural and political orientations. This map demonstrates that 16th century Italy had much more tangible exchanges with the long distance interactions that marked that period that we usually admit. The world was not just on the walls, but most of all behind them. Thank you very much.
Donc on a un peu de temps pour la discussion. We can, I think you can take questions in either English or French.
Yeah, of course. In English or French is fine.
Yeah.
Okay. If any.
Can I ask you about the libraries? Are there any traces actually in either the Florentine collections or the others at this time of any of these non-European textual materials?
We have the cases, of course, of the that you also mentioned, of the Mexican codes, the codices that arrived exactly to Florence in these years, in Ferdinando's years, for instance. But as far as we refer to the two very attractive sources mentioned by João de Barros, unluckily, I don't have any information of their presence there. There is also a very problematic point if they were really the copies of the originals written in Persian and Chinese, or as I think more probably translated, copies translated into Portuguese or something else. But as far as I know, we just have an interesting comment by a 17th century Portuguese learned man who wrote that Jovia was very unfair with João de Barros because he used his materials without mentioning him. This is an interesting thing that we could include in this attempt to look for this material, and that seems to show that perhaps, at least for the readers, there was some evidence of the use of these materials, but as far as I know, there is no, these materials have not been found in the libraries.